I'm Laura Murphy-Oates, and this is The Full Story.
Two queens stand before me. Ladies, this is your last chance to impress me, earn the first win of the season, and a cash tip. $5,000. The time has come.
The reality TV show RuPaul's Drag Race is an international sensation with spin-off series around the world. In the show, drag queens compete for the crown by showing off their skills in comedy, dancing, sewing, and throwing shade. Australia's first season, Drag Race Down Under, is currently airing on the streaming service Stan.
You're standing on your chiffon.
Jojo Zaho, the show's first ever Aboriginal drag queen, was eliminated in the first episode, but still made a big impression in a season that's been full of controversy, particularly around issues of race. Today, Jojo Zaho on Drag Race and First Nations representation. It's Monday, the 21st of June.
So my name is John Ridgway. I am a proud Biripi Warramai man, and I also perform under the stage name Jojo Zaho.
Mm-hmm. Why Jojo Zaho?
So when I was a kid, my sister would dress me up as a girl. I was so reluctant to it. No. And so she would call me Josephine. And then I was a teenager, and my sister and my best friend still fought over who started calling me Jojo first, but it was one of them.
Yeah.
And so when it came time for a drag name, I was like, well, I'll just go with Jojo. It's a name that I'm already used to hearing, so I'll just go with that. And then it was just Jojo. I hadn't kind of come up with the last name or anything. And then I was on the phone to my best friend complaining because I needed a last name for Facebook. So she was like, all right, I'm going to text you a name, say Jojo, and then the name I've texted you out loud and see what happens. And so the first time I read it the same way everyone else reads it these days, as I put the emphasis on the A. So I was like, Jojo Zaho. I'm like, that sounds weird. That makes sense. Jojo. She's like, you're trying too hard. Just read it. I'm like, Jojo Zaho. I'm like, oh my God, that's it. Bingo.
Yeah, she's, you got to give her a lot of credit. That's a great.
Oh, point. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I was just, it works so well because it looks, on paper, it looks a little bit exotic. It looks a little bit fancy. And then at the core of it, it's just like, yeah, Jojo's a whore, basically.
Okay, so tell me a bit about how your drag career started.
Like, you know, obviously my sister dressed me up, so it wasn't something that I'd never done before. But it wasn't until 2015 I was at Dubbo. And it was around the time of the marriage equality debate and the government was voting on it, figuring out their position, where they stood on the policy. And so the council meeting was open up to the public. So me and some friends went, and an Indigenous council member stood up, and it was his turn to talk. And he talked about, you know, I understand what it's like to be discriminated against and vilified. And, you know, I was crucified for something that I couldn't control. I can't change my skin color, that kind of thing. So I was like, oh, awesome. He gets it. Like, he's going to be great. And then he finished with basically, but I don't believe homosexuality is part of the Indigenous culture. And being the only queer Indigenous person in the council chambers that time, all my friends just kind of did that lean forward and look to me, and I'm just like, this guy right here, you were doing so well. It was like that Tyra Banks moment. We were rooting for you. We were all rooting for you.
That would have been rough, though, for sure.
Yeah, and it was just kind of a slap in the face. I'm like, clearly you don't know that much about your culture if you think that's true. But anyway, so, and then a few months later, Dubbo was having their annual Pride March. And so I thought, as a nice little FU, I would go in drag in a costume that was made out of both the Indigenous flag and the gay pride flag as my kind of way of saying, like, you're wrong. I'm like, how can I piss him off the most? And this is what I came up with.
Can you describe what that was like? I mean, what did that first Pride March look like, and then what was it like for you being there in that outfit?
Subjectively, it was amazing. It was the Central West. It wasn't something that a lot of the queer community in the Central West ever thought that would happen. And then I remember getting up, it was like 5 a.m. and, you know, I was doing my makeup, and a friend was helping me doing my makeup as well. And so, you know, I got there and I'm in the car and I'm on the way and I'm like, oh, this is uncomfortable. I got stuff sticking in everywhere. And then I just remember getting out of the car and it's just like, oh, crap, I'm about to walk down the street dressed like a woman. The realization kind of hit me and I'm like, well, I'm already here. I've committed to this. This is what I'm going to do. Let's just do it.
Can you just describe the outfit a tiny bit more? What did it look like?
It was a strapless corset kind of situation.
Yeah.
And the top half was made of the Indigenous flag and the bottom half was made of the gay pride flag. So that was a long train that stayed behind me about 3 meters long.
Mm.
And it also tied into the reason I had it so long was to tie into the story of the Rainbow Serpent as well. So there was a lot of thought that went into it. And it was just one of those beautiful moments, like walking down the street and then seeing all the young Indigenous kids pointing at me because they see the flag on my costume, pointing at me because they see representation in that parade, was just beautiful. And like they were waving, like the parents were waving. It was just one of those beautiful moments that kind of hit me because I was like, I didn't have this growing up. I didn't have this kind of representation. This is something that I never got to see.
Mm-hmm.
And so for them to get to see it by me doing it, like, meant so much because I'm like, it was one of those things that instantly it occurred to me that right now I'm the representation that I needed growing up and I get to be that representation for them. So it kind of dawned on me while I was walking, you know, trying to smile and wave that this is a lot bigger than metaphorically giving a council member the bird. And it's so much bigger than that. It was bigger than me.
You mentioned that you didn't have that growing up, that type of queer representation. Can you tell me a little bit about your childhood? Where did you grow up and what was it like?
Well, I was born in Melbourne and then we moved to New South Wales and we moved around a lot. And then we moved to a town called Kurri. I was there for about a year and then I went off to live with my uncle and stuff and his family on Warburton Mission in Western Australia for a while.
Mm.
But I did the bulk of my growing up from year three till I finished high school in Kurri. It's a small town. It used to be a coal mining town.
And what was it like for you being a queer black kid in that environment?
Well, see, I didn't really have to worry about any sort of queerness showing up or being talked about because it was a predominantly white town.
Mm.
So if anyone was to kind of pick on me, the first thing that they would go for was my skin color. So I got to have my skin color as a scapegoat to hide my queerness. Because my skin colour was the first thing they focused on. They wouldn't focus on whether, oh, is he gay, is he straight? It just didn't really come up that much. I'd walk down the school hallways and someone would walk past and cough the N-word. And for a while it sucked, like it was awful. And I remember I used to cry to mum when I think it was around year six. How come Michael Jackson can change his skin colour but why can't I change mine?
Oof.
And, you know, it takes you to a dark place where you just build up this resentment for your skin color because it's something you can't hide. It's something that people always see. And that's a lot for a 10-year-old to kind of have to deal with. No kid should have those feelings towards themselves. And you know, my mum did the best she could. She would just sit there and remind me that my skin color is beautiful and people pay a fortune to have skin like mine. And one day I'm going to recognize how beautiful my skin is. I'm going to love all of that. It's just going to take a lot of work for me to get there. She was always supportive and would kind of do her best to talk me off that kind of ledge because my father passed away and he was my Indigenous connection because mum's non-Indigenous. So she would just do the best she could in a situation that she never really thought she'd have to prepare for. But yeah, and then I just kind of got to a point where I didn't care what people thought about my skin colour. I think it was around year nine that I just started to fully embrace and accept. And I'm like, I don't care what people think. And, you know, the same people would walk down the hallway and cough the N-word at me. And I'd literally just turn around and point out how stupid they are. I'm like, if you're going to be racist, at least use the right words. I'm like, I'm not African-American. That word doesn't apply to me. If you're going to be racist, use this word. Mm. You can tell your parents are siblings, can't you? That kind of stuff. And that's kind of where I developed a bit of a quick wit as a defense mechanism. If someone tried to insult me or kind of read me, I would slaughter them verbally.
It's where, a lot of that wit that I imagine working as a drag queen, you're interacting with the audience and having to have comebacks on hand. Sounds like you were prepped.
I literally would have a comeback for everything. My friends used to laugh and joke. They would like, do you sit on the toilet and just think of comebacks?
Yeah. I was born in Melbourne. We moved around a lot. You know, I've lived on a mission in WA for like 12 months.
What's the mission?
The best way to describe it was like back in the day, it was like a concentration camp for black people.
Something that you spoke about really powerfully on RuPaul's Drag Race and I've heard you speak about elsewhere is living for a time as a kid on a mission. And you called them concentration camps for Aboriginal people, I think.
Yeah, look, poor choice of wording. But it was the closest thing that I could think of that would instantly make people understand what kind of place they were. It was just the only thing I could think, compare it to for, a white audience to understand the severity of what a mission actually was.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I've struggled with, like, throughout my life is my connection to my culture. It was one of those things that I didn't like because it made me stand out.
Each town, like on the outer edges of that town, would be missions where the black people would live and they weren't allowed to go into town. You needed permission to leave the mission.
It was nothing like that when I lived there. Those times they were just remnants of what used to be a mission. Now they're mostly just townships. But yeah.
It is interesting, as you've spoken about, in the current day, missions and reserves around Australia have become homes with strong cultural connections for people and you know, can be very beautiful places, but they have this incredibly dark history. My dad spent some time on a reserve where my family were subject to social control and weren't able to go into town without an exemption certificate. Do you think enough Australians know about this type of history?
Absolutely not. The history that I was taught growing up, you kind of get a rose-tinted version. You hear about the Stolen Generation and you're told, you know, these people were taken from their families and put in these places, and that's about it. You don't hear about what life was like living in those places to the degree that we probably should. It's kind of like a parent giving their children half-truths to protect them from the truth, almost.
Do you think that drag has an important role to kind of play in that education process and in that visibility for Indigenous queens, kind of opening that conversation up?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that was one of the things that I took upon myself going into this. I'm like, all right, I've got an international platform here. I've been given an international voice here. I'm not obligated to talk about anything, but I feel like that I've been given such a monumentous and unique opportunity that I have like a responsibility that I kind of put on myself. Yeah, I know it's 2021 and all that stuff, but we're still not given that many mainstream platforms to talk about this kind of stuff. You know, conversations on shows like Q&A, they're amazing and they're great, but not a lot of people watch Q&A.
A lot of people do watch RuPaul's Drag Race all around the world. It's true, yeah.
The kind of audience that you want to reach is already educated enough with watching Q&As. We need to reach the audience that wouldn't necessarily go out of their way or sit through an episode of Q&A to learn these kinds of things and listen to these conversations. So for me, it was like, it wasn't even a second thought. It was like, this is what I'm doing. I had a notebook that I had dot points of things that I would work into conversations. And yeah, as soon as she asked me about my hometown, I'm like, this is where I can take this conversation.
Time for education.
Yeah.
Next, inside RuPaul's Drag Race. I'm interested in how this process of coming on the show worked. How did you actually apply for RuPaul's Drag Race, or, you know, how do they select the queens?
So my understanding was they wanted this to be a huge secret, wanted it to be a international surprise. So they would reach out to, I think they reached out to about 300 queens via social media. Initially, I was like, this is sketchy. Who is this? Because they message you like, hi, we've got an opportunity we think you'd be interested in New Zealand. If you'd love to hear more, let me know. So I was like, yeah, I'd love to hear more. They're like, all right, we need you to sign an NDA before we can tell you anything. So I was like, okay. So I got the NDA and I printed it off. I didn't even open the document. I just printed it off first because I'm like, yeah, I'll sign this. And then I finished printing it and the Warner Brothers logo was on top and I was just like, okay, what's going here? And as the interview process kept going and going, I'm saying to my partner, because I made him sign an NDA before I talked to him about it because it was Warner Brothers and I wasn't getting sued. so I, like, he was fully in on it and I was just like, I'm pretty sure this is Drag Race. I'm like, I can't say for certain, but I'm just like, something in my gut tells me that this is Drag Race Australia or Australasia or something. And so, you know, we would had a series of interviews and psychological evaluations and everything. And then they kind of narrowed it down to a short list. And then we get an email saying that we've been chosen. And then in the email is where you see it in print where it says Drag Race Down Under. Because before that, they never mentioned it. They never told us it was Drag Race.
How did you react when you found out that it was?
My first words were, holy shit. This is Drag Race. Like I got the email and I'm looking at it on my iPad and I just put the iPad down and I'm like, wow. All right. This is going to be hectic.
What does the show mean to you? What did it mean to you?
So for a drag queen, it's kind of, I don't want to say it's end game, but it's the launching pad.
Mm.
It's intimidating. It's humbling. It's exciting. It's nerve wracking. It's just so many things. But for me, it just being on there meant so much because I'm like, I get to be that First Nation representative.
Mm.
And that just fills me with not so much with pride that I, yes, it's me. They've picked me. But it's just like, I get this opportunity. This is amazing.
Up next, Newcastle's Jojo Zaho.
How dare you?
I am serving you Aboriginal Empire, channeling Marie Antoinette, Queen of the Kuris, and I've got a giant, giant surprise under my dress that I flash the judges with.
You immediately made a statement, as we talked about, you were talking about the mission, but you also wore this gown in one of the first challenges. Can you describe that gown to me?
So that was my hometown gown. You've got little princess puffy sleeves, very Disney, ruffled collar, Marie Antoinette hair. On my waist, I'm wearing a bustle and a skirt that has handprints all over it to kind of represent like a cave painting. Again, it's something that is easily recognizable to a white audience.
Mm.
And then whenever I lift the skirt up through the wooden poles in the skirt, it drops down a sign that says, always was, always will be.
Ooh. Australia will always be Aboriginal land. Sovereignty was never ceded, always was and always will be.
I think JoJo means business.
And I'd worn that before. So that was my best national costume for Miss First Nations 2019.
Mm.
And so that gown was always coming. That sign is dropping down. That statement is being made.
Mm.
I just need to figure out how to work it. I'm like, even if it doesn't fit the category, if it sends me home, then so be it. But that dress, that sign is being dropped down. And so that dress, I call it the Empire of White Australia built by black hands.
That's great.
And that's what I nicknamed it. It's my empire costume. And so for me, it's to give you that regal, imperialistic royal silhouette, but 100% unapologetically black.
What were you hoping that people would take away from seeing not just that gown, but that saying, that famous saying of Indigenous activism?
So I had two takeaways from that. I was like, the Aussie audience will get it. They'll know what I stand for. They'll know what kind of queen I am. The community will see it, and I hope they love it. From what I've heard, they do. But going into it, I'm like, I hope they love and I hope they get what I'm trying to do. The other one was the international audience will have no idea what I'm talking about.
Mm.
But if it encourages them to Google always was, always will be, it will lead them down a rabbit hole of information where they can learn about Australia's First Nation history and activism and the struggles that we've been through.
Has that happened?
Absolutely. I've gotten messages from First Nation people in Brazil, Canada, in the United States, messaging me that, like thanking me for putting it out there so that they could learn the history about Australia's First Nation people because not a lot of it is known. Mm. They've also messaged like, thank you for being an Indigenous representation. I understand that I'm not Indigenous Australian. I'm Indigenous like Canadian or Brazilian. Like their First Nations people message me and tell me how proud they are to see just any sort of Indigenous representation and start that conversation and be unapologetic about it and have those conversations about colonization in a way that is informative but isn't stifling to a white audience.
Has anyone ever done anything in drag that they regret?
My first three runways.
I've said and done things that I regret in drag a lot. When I was a lot younger and stupid and naive, just trying desperately to make people laugh, recently got called out on it.
Well, what did you do, Scarlett?
I have in the past, as long as a lot of the other queens, done blackface before, which I really regret. I'm disgusted in myself that I did those things.
There have been some controversies with how the show has handled issues around race. One of them being the fact that one of the queens, Scarlett Adams, does have a history of blackface, geisha makeup.
Asian face.
Lots of stuff.
Muslim face.
Yes.
Native American face. I mean, no culture left unturned.
Mm. Did you know about this history before you went on the show at all?
No. Some of the queens had heard and some queens had knew about it. None of them wanted to tell me because they didn't want me to kind of have that black girl edit. Where I might get angry at her and then it could be edited in a way that I just come across as angry. So I didn't find out until I finished filming. And then I started to, because I was going through Reddit and everything, and I started to see stuff pop up and all that. And then once the cast was announced, I'd received a bunch of messages. But, yeah, I had no idea going into it what kind of past they had.
All right, now, Scarlett, before you leave, there's something we need to talk about. It's just come to my attention that there are photos of you online performing in blackface. And I want to give you an opportunity to address this.
I can't deny that happened. As a dumb, ignorant teenager, I made some mistakes that I'm really not proud of. And every day I regret those decisions. I regret the fact that I used my platform as a performer to ridicule people who have faced systematic racism for hundreds of years. And I'm so ashamed of the person that I once was. I'm really sorry to you and to everyone that I've hurt.
Is that type of performance in drag something that surprised you, hearing that someone had done that in Australian drag?
Yes and no. So I know Aussie drag for a while was very tongue-in-cheek and would kind of dance along the line of appreciation and appropriation. Mm. And, you know, select few would occasionally cross that. So it didn't really surprise me that much, but at the same time, the extent of it was what surprised me, that it wasn't just limited to blackface. It was literally no culture left unturned. That kind of surprised me in a way that's like, oh, okay, so this isn't really a one-off thing. This is their brand, basically, of what kind of queen they were.
Mm.
I'm not happy with what Scarlett's done in her past, and like it would have been great to have someone who's not so controversial on the show, but at the same time, them being there and having done what they did is sparking a lot of conversations, and a lot of people are starting to hold themselves accountable in terms of their own actions, or they're holding their friends accountable. The history of Aussie drag is being looked at. You know, Whereas if it was to just go unnoticed, those conversations wouldn't have happened. People wouldn't be holding themselves accountable.
Now, I'm sure there are people that would want me to cancel you right here, right now. But I'd rather this be a lesson in humility and accountability. And I pray that all of us can learn and grow from our mistakes. Thank you.
You've kind of touched on it there, but I suppose RuPaul's Drag Race does have this history of platforming LGBTQI voices, but particularly Indigenous people of colour all around the world, and giving them a space to talk about really difficult issues internationally.
Yeah.
And I think there was a lot of expectation and hope that that will happen here in Australia. Are you confident that it has, that it was as diverse and radical as the show could have been?
Well, I think it was for its first season. Obviously, there would have been a lot more conversations if I had the luck of staying longer. But it's one of those things that hopefully it's not the last one. And so the next First Nation queen that gets invited can kind of pick up where I left off and have those conversations. And that's one of those things that I'm also looking forward to, because I don't just speak for all First Nation people. My experiences and my stories are different to others. Hopefully, with future First Nation queens being on the show and moving forward, you'll get a lot more of a perspective and a lot more of idea from different stories as well. But no, it could have been blacker. It could have been. Look, it wasn't a blizzard, but it could have been blacker.
That's it for today. This episode was produced by Joe Koning, Miles Herbert and Ryan Pemberton. The executive producers of Full Story are Miles Martignoni and myself, Laura Murphy-Oates. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave a rating or a review. Okay, catch you tomorrow.